Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the October 26, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows President Trump, and he's standing next to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And between them, it's kind of dark in the background. Between them, they're holding what looks to be kind of a crystal ball. They're holding it together. And inside the ball, you see the image of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And they're both smiling, and the title is Seeing No Evil: Why Trump is Buying the Saudis' Denials They Murdered Khashoggi. And in fact, I think that's our first main story. Saudis deny Khashoggi killing as evidence mounts. What happened? President Trump defended Saudi Arabia this week against charges that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, saying he'll await results of the Saudis' own investigation. After speaking with Prince Mohammed and King Salman, Trump said that both men made strong denials of any involvement in Khashoggi's assassination, and he suggested that rogue killers may have been involved. Turkish authorities say they have audio tapes proving that Khashoggi, a Saudi native and legal U.S. resident, was tortured, killed, and dismembered minutes after he entered the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul 2 weeks ago. A team of 15 Saudi agents was allegedly waiting for him there, according to Turkish authorities. The Saudi assassins allegedly cut off Khashoggi's fingers while he was alive and then beheaded him, with a forensics doctor dissecting the body with a bone saw. The New York Times independently confirmed that at least 9 of the 15 suspects identified by Turkish authorities worked for the Saudi government. Many of them have close ties to Prince Mohammed, who is the country's de facto ruler. Trump, who has prioritized close ties with Saudi Arabia, said he hoped the investigation would prove that the royals were not involved. "We need Saudi Arabia," Trump said. He said the charge that the Saudis murdered the journalist reminded him of the sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. "Here we go again," Trump said. "Guilty until proven innocent." What the editorial said: the Saudi cover-up is crumbling, said the New York Times, but President Trump continues to buy into the kingdom's lame denials. Trump's excuse-making is all too familiar, coming from a president who has lavished praise on authoritarians Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un. If this ghastly crime goes unanswered, the world's growing gang of autocrats will feel even less constraint. "The U.S. cannot afford to lose Saudi Arabia as an ally," said WashingtonExaminer.com. "We need the Saudis to help contain our common enemy, Iran, which conducts far more deadly operations outside its borders on a routine basis." But Americans shouldn't lightly accept, let alone defend, that their allies should engage in such vile crimes as this one. Once all the facts are known, there needs to be concrete consequences for those involved in Khashoggi's killing, such as sanctions on individuals who are responsible. Trump's credibility is at stake if he accepts this monstrous behavior with nothing more than a shrug. What the columnist said: why is Trump so willing to let the Saudis slide? Asks Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. He now denies having any financial interests in Saudi Arabia, but the president has repeatedly boasted about his business dealings with the kingdom. They buy apartments from me. They spend $40 million, $50 million. Am I supposed to dislike them? He said in 2015. The Saudis have also poured money into his hotels. When the Crown Prince visited New York City in March, his vast entourage helped Trump International Hotel grow its revenue 13% after 2 years of declines. Sadly, Trump's finances are still a mystery because a pliant Republican Congress lets him get away with it. Congress isn't giving the Saudis a free pass, said Matthew Continetti in FreeBeacon.com. A bipartisan group of senators is pushing for sanctions, but Congress should think carefully before doing anything rash, such as cutting off military aid. It would not benefit the U.S. if Iran ends up gaining the most from the Khashoggi affair. Look, the Saudis do a lots of awful and appalling things, including beheading convicted criminals, said Sohrab Ahmari in CommentaryMagazine.com. Nevertheless, they're vital allies in a region full of enemies, so our response must be measured. Until now, Prince Mohammed has played the West like a fiddle, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. He has won bipartisan cheers from Washington, Silicon Valley, and Wall Street for symbolic reforms like allowing women to drive and opening movie theaters in the kingdom. Meanwhile, he's bombed Yemeni weddings and school buses, imprisoned scores of dissidents and rivals, and even kidnapped the prime minister of Lebanon while consolidating power. Saudi Arabia's mad prince doesn't belong at celebratory state dinners. He belongs in a prison cell. Our controversy of the week this week is titled, Are Democrats to Blame? What the heck has happened to the Democratic Party, said Frank Pavone in the WashingtonExaminer.com. Democrats have always had an extremist fringe of wannabe revolutionaries, but in recent weeks, the party's leaders have also sounded like radicals. Hillary Clinton last week defended the harassment of Republican senators during the confirmation fight over Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, saying, "You cannot be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for." Not to be outdone, former Attorney General Eric Holder called on liberals to replace Michelle Obama's famous maxim, "When they go low, we go high," with the more aggressive, "When they go low, we kicked them." Holder claims he wasn't being literal, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. But Democrats really are acting like a mob. In recent weeks, leftists have hounded Senator Ted Cruz and his wife out of a restaurant, pounded on the doors of the Supreme Court to protest Kavanaugh's confirmation, and harassed anyone wearing a MAGA hat, Make America Great Again hat. Obviously, liberals are so frustrated by their lack of political power that they're turning to threats and physical intimidation. What disingenuous nonsense, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. Clinton and Holder didn't advocate violence. They called on Democrats to use harder-edged but legal tactics to defend democracy from a Republican Party with no scruples left whatsoever. The GOP stands united behind an authoritarian president who repeatedly urged violence against protesters at his campaign rallies, who threatens political opponents with jail, and who regularly uses Twitter and raucous mob rallies to harass and belittle anyone, especially women and minorities, who dares challenge him. Let's not forget that Trump caged kids like animals after tearing them away from their parents, said Sarah Jones in NYMag.com, or that he heartlessly mimicked and mocked Christine Blasey Ford's somber testimony that Kavanaugh sexually abused her. And you want Democrats to respond with better etiquette? Legally protected protest is the proper response, said David French in NationalReview.com. But there is a yawning legal and moral gap between Trump supporters chanting "lock her up" at a controlled political rally and a mob chasing Cruz out of a restaurant, surrounding senators on elevators and hallways, or disrupting the Kavanaugh hearings with shouting and histrionics. There is simply no place for the mob in a constitutional republic. Democrats have convinced themselves that their current president, Congress, and the Supreme Court are all illegitimate, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. That kind of thinking fuels violence and is more dangerous to our democracy than Trump. Is that so? Said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Conservatives are actually arguing that a handful of protesters heckling Cruz in a restaurant is more alarming than the President of the United States calling for the imprisonment of his political opponents in a stadium filled with thousands of entranced supporters howling, "Lock her up." The only reason the Justice Department hasn't locked up Hillary or shut down the Russia investigation is that a few key officials have refused to bow to this president's authoritarian demand. Still, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com, the question facing Democrats is whether adopting Trumpian tactics of incivility is worth the long-term damage to American government. Sooner or later, Democrats will regain power and will want to reclaim the mantle of civility. Once it's gone, as the GOP is already learning, it can be very, very hard to get it back. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for gingers, with new research suggesting that people who carry the gene responsible for red hair also have a lower perceived age. The study found that carriers of the MC1R gene look roughly 2 years younger than their biological age. It was a good week for telemetrics, with the launch in South Korea of a diaper insert that informs parents via a smartphone app when their baby has peed or pooped and needs a change. And it was a good week for deadlines after Bloomberg.com reported that special counsel Robert Mueller is racing to complete reports on whether President Trump conspired with the Russians and obstructed justice and will issue his findings right after the November 6 midterm elections. But it was a bad week for civility after a coven of New York's witches announced a ceremony to formally hex newly minted Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. "We intend to make Kavanaugh suffer," said organizer Dakota Bracali. "Basically, it's all about causing suffering." It was a bad week for sharing after reports that a California high school student came to school with cookies made in part from her grandmother's ashes and distributed them to her classmates. "This is a weird one," a police spokesman said, adding that there has been no indication of anybody being harmed physically by the cookies. And finally, it was a bad week for priorities. With estimates that Americans will this year collectively spend $480 million on Halloween costumes for their pets. This is more than double the amount spent on pet costumes back in 2010, an increase, say experts, that reflects people being able to send out photos of costumed dogs and cats on social media. And while we're here, we'll read a boring but important item titled, "The Bill Comes Due for Last Year's Tax Cut." The U.S. budget deficit has jumped to $779 billion. The Treasury Department reported this week, up more than $110 billion from fiscal year 2017. Though a strong economy did nudge federal revenues up 0.5%, corporate tax collections plunged 31% because of last year's tax cuts. When Congress debated the tax cut last year, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said the tax plan would not just pay for itself, but it will pay down the debt. Now, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell calls for the rising debt very disturbing, though he blames it on entitlement programs such as Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has said the U.S. is on track to run up a $1 trillion deficit in 2020. Our briefing page article this week is titled, "The Resistance State. California wants no part of President Trump's America. Their battle is likely headed for the Supreme Court." How is California resisting? With nearly 40 million residents and the fifth largest economy in the world, California is big enough to be its own country. And in many ways, it has started to act like one. Governor Jerry Brown and an overwhelmingly Democratic legislature currently enjoy one of the fastest growing economies in the U.S., a booming clean energy sector, and a $9 billion budget surplus. Confident of success, they're pursuing a liberal policy agenda diametrically opposed to President Trump's. As the Trump administration cuts financial and environmental regulations, weakens Obama-era programs, and cracks down on immigration, California is leading a coalition of blue states fighting back. It has sued the Trump administration nearly 40 times. California has positioned itself as the center of the Trump resistance, said Los Angeles-based law professor Jessica Levinson. It's bloody combat. What are they fighting over? Basically, everything. Many disputes concern whether the Trump administration has ultimate authority to repeal or cease enforcing regulations involving student loans, net neutrality, birth control, farming safety, transgender rights, and banking protections, to name a few. More than a quarter of Californians are foreign-born, and the state has also been Trump's fiercest opponent on immigration. California challenged the Muslim travel ban last March, though the Supreme Court ultimately upheld it, and successfully filed suit against the zero-tolerance policy of separating migrant families at the border. In addition, California sued to prevent Trump's repeal of the program that protects Dreamers who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children. And federal courts have temporarily blocked Trump's repeal. California's status as a sanctuary state was demonstrated in February when Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf posted a tweet alerting residents of an upcoming immigration sweep. A livid Attorney General Jeff Sessions accused California of using every power it has to undermine duly established immigration law. Why is California so important? The state's huge economy gives it outsized influence over national policy, especially environmental protections. With more than 35 million vehicles registered in California, Auto companies can't afford to make one fleet of cars complying with federal rules and another fleet following stricter standards in California. The state reached its goal of reducing emissions to 1990 levels in 2016, 4 years earlier than targeted. In May, a coalition of 17 states led by California sued to block the Environmental Protection Agency from weakening auto emissions rules. "This is about health. It's about life and death," Brown said. "I'm going to fight it with everything I can." How has Trump responded? The president visited California in March and spent much of his trip inspecting prototypes for a wall along the southern border, seemingly to troll the majority of Californians who vehemently oppose his signature proposal. "The place is totally out of control," Trump said during his trip. "The governor's doing a terrible job." He said sanctuary cities breed crime and threaten to withhold federal funds as a weapon against California if it won't cooperate with immigration enforcement. This summer, Trump essentially blamed the state for its own wildfire crisis, arguing in a tweet that the blazes were made so much worse by the bad environmental laws. His aides later argued that the state's strict limits on logging and forests set the stage for worse fires, a claim environmentalists and even the logging industry disputed. Isn't the GOP for states' rights? Yes, but Republicans argue that California is actually fighting to defend the federal overreach of previous Democratic administrations. Many of the state's lawsuits seek to force the federal government to continue a program on regulation or regulation, whether it's protecting wetlands, requiring oil and gas operators to reduce methane emissions, or providing health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Some Republicans say politicians in California are merely seeking to capitalize on Trump's unpopularity there. It's all a carefully orchestrated plan to distract California voters from what's really going on in the state, said California GOP Chairman Jim Brilt. How will this end? After California failed to stop the Federal Communications Commission from repealing net neutrality laws, the state passed its own strict standards last month, which the Justice Department immediately sued to prevent. Once again, the California legislature has enacted an extreme and illegal state law attempting to frustrate federal policy, Sessions said. Some of the lawsuits challenging the Trump administration, including those concerning sanctuary laws, auto pollution standards, and a proposed census question about immigration status, will almost certainly be settled by the Supreme Court. The court now has a solid 5-4 conservative majority, so California's attempt to chart its own course could be in jeopardy. We'll read a few of the best columns of the week. This first one's from the U.S. It says, "Nationalism shouldn't be dismissed." In the U.S. and throughout the world, a nationalist backlash is shaping our politics, said John Judas. Nationalism has been seized mostly by the political right with an overt racial and anti-immigrant messaging. But liberals are making a mistake in dismissing the valid concerns that have fueled these movements. In recent decades, globalization has benefited multinational corporations, China, and the developing world, but its benefits have sailed over the heads of middle-class Americans. Free to seek cheap labor outside the U.S., companies have enjoyed a race to the bottom on wages, taxes, and regulation, hollowing out the middle class and leaving America filled with desolate, left-behind factory towns. Unfortunately, President Trump has laced his version of nationalism with overtly racist, anti-immigrant appeals. But his policies have not been without merit. He's right to challenge China's ongoing theft of U.S. technology and other intellectual property and its protectionist trade policies, and to champion America's manufacturing industries and their workers. A common national identity is essential to democracies, providing the glue that keeps them together. Liberals dismiss the surge of nationalist feelings at their own peril. And this from Germany, somewhat related, I think. Germany, backlash against the far right. Germans are fed up with the hate mongers of the far right, said Karsten Polk Majewski in Die Zeit. 3 years ago, when the country took in more than a million distraught, exhausted, and disoriented migrants from the Middle East and Africa, thousands of Germans rolled up their sleeves to help. They built cots, sorted clothes, and collected toys for their new neighbors, and offered free German lessons. At the same time, other Germans recoiled in fear. Fear of losing their culture, of rising crime, of terrorism, of overstretched public services. Those frightened Germans have been loud and organized, and they have made the once fringe far-right Alternative for Germany, the AfD, into the third largest party in the legislature, taking 13% of the vote in last year's election. That's significant, but it is far, far from a majority. And last week, the true majority, the helper Germans, took to the streets to make their own message heard. United under the banner hashtag Unteilbar, or indivisible, nearly 250,000 people packed the three-mile span from Alexanderplatz through Brandenburg Gate to the Victory Column in Berlin. They were leftist, centrist, pro-refugee groups, Muslim groups, Jewish groups, the young and the old, all demanding that Germany remain an open and free society. Some of those marching, though, were as unsavory as the skinheads they despise, said Julian Röpke in Bild. As well as concerned citizens, the demonstrators included Islamists, leftist extremists, anti-Semites, and supporters of the secular Kurdish terrorist group PKK. There were Turkish nationalists and promoters of the Muslim Brotherhood. No wonder some of Germany's leading moderate Muslims declined to participate, saying you can't fight Nazis by aligning yourself with Islamofascists. To avoid such an unpleasant aftertaste at the next big protest, maybe organizers shouldn't be so indivisible, but rather divide themselves from extremists and Islamists. The big tent was exactly the point, said Ariane Bammer in Der Tagesspiegel. The Indivisible March's slogan, for solidarity and against exclusion, was meant to be broad enough to encompass disparate groups. AfD likes to claim that only a small elite supports the concept of an open society. This demonstration shows that actually it's everyone but them. That's because the AfD isn't just against refugees, said Christian Jacob in the Tagesanzeigung. They want teachers to be punished for discussing discrimination in the classroom, lawyers to be shamed for arguing for migrant clients' rights of residence, journalists to be silenced, same-sex marriage to be banned, and a litany of other authoritarian demands. To stop them, we need to work not just with like-minded allies, but also with those we find problematic. The division in Germany is stark, said Raphael Thelen in Der Spiegel. On one side stand the authoritarians, on the other side, the advocates of freedom. This week, supporters of democracy showed the world that we will not let Germany slip backward. And finally, a column from India. Can Me Too change our culture? Indian women are naming and shaming their abusers, said the Indian Express. The Me Too movement has unleashed a crescendo of rage, trauma, and anguish in this country as women tell their stories of being propositioned at work, followed, harassed, groped, and even raped. They have revealed a toxic patriarchal culture so ingrained as to be inevitable, and a justice system that fails them at every level. Every profession is implicated. Journalist-turned-politician MJ Akbar now has at least 15 accusers. Comedian Utsav Chakraborty faces numerous allegations. Times of India editor K.R. Srinivas has been put on leave for being accused by 7 women of sexual misconduct. To many men, this public pillorying seems like anarchy. Can a reputation now be destroyed by a tweet? But they must remember that women are going public because other routes have failed them. Complaints of harassment to superiors have brought no relief. Complaints to police are too often ignored. This movement hasn't gone too far. It hasn't gone far enough. It needs to spread to the startup cultures riddled by the bro code, and especially to the informal work sector, where the weakest of women battle the most unequal working conditions. Indian institutions must accept their complicity in pervasive injustice and change. It's going to be a long, fraught journey. And our in-depth article, the last word, is titled Still Standing. And in the middle is an image that I've seen several times on television. And the subtitle is, amid the devastation wreaked by Hurricane Michael, one structure remained intact, said Patricia Mazai. This is the story of the Florida seafront home built to withstand the big one. And the caption on the picture says, King built the sand palace to withstand the fiercest hurricane winds. It did. And you see the white two-story house on stilts, standing alone beachfront with pure wreckage around it. As they built their dream house last year on the shimmering sands of the Gulf of Mexico, Russell King and his nephew, Dr. LeBron Lackey, painstakingly documented every detail of the elevated construction, from the 40-foot pilings buried into the ground to the types of screws drilled into the walls. They picked gleaming paints from a palette of shore colors, chose salt-tolerant species to plant in the beach dunes, and christened their creation the Sand Palace of Mexico Beach. They also installed an outdoor security camera. Its video footage became the only view of their property as Hurricane Michael thundered ashore last week, the most intense storm recorded in the history of the Florida Panhandle. The camera showed a horrifying tunnel of gray fury worsening by the hour as Lackey, a 54-year-old radiologist, stared helplessly from more than 400 miles away at the corner of his roof. It would buck like an airplane wing, he said from his residence in Cleveland, Tennessee. I kept expecting to see it tear off, but it did not. When the New York Times published an analysis of aerial images showing a mile-long stretch of Mexico Beach, where at least three-quarters of the buildings were damaged, Lackey saw his sand palace still standing, majestic amid the apocalyptic wreckage, the last surviving beachfront house on his block. We wanted to build it for the big one, he said. We just never knew we'd find the big one so fast. The story of how the Sand Palace made it through Michael while most of its neighbors collapsed is one about building in hurricane-prone Florida and how construction regulations failed to imagine the Category 4 monster's catastrophic destruction. Florida's building code, put into effect in 2002, is famously stringent when it comes to windstorm resistance for homes built along the hurricane-prone Atlantic shoreline. but it is less so for structures along the Panhandle, a region historically unaffected by storms as strong as the ones that have slammed into South Florida. After Hurricane Andrew, a Category 5 beast, ravaged Miami-Dade County in 1992, new construction in the southern portion of the state was required to withstand 175-mile-per-hour winds. In the coastal Panhandle counties affected by Michael, the requirement is lower, 120 to 150 miles per hour, and the rule for certain kinds of reinforcement have applied to houses built more than a mile from the shore only since 2007. Many of the residences and businesses rubbed out by Michael in Mexico Beach were far older. Rebuilding them to conform to the new code will be expensive and could price out some of the working class people who historically have flocked to Mexico Beach. King would not say how much he and Lackey spent to fortify the beachside home, which public records show has been assessed for tax purposes at a value of $400,000. Their architect, Charles A. Gaskin, said that building a house the way they did roughly doubles the cost per square foot compared with ordinary building practices. Other experts had different views of the expense required. An estimate published in Forbes in 2012 said implementing an array of storm resistance measures, including some of those advised by the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, would add more than $30,000 to the cost of a typical house. Every time something like this happens, you have to say to yourself, is there something we can do better? Governor Rick Scott told reporters as public officials were called upon once again to examine the state's building standards. When I saw this hurricane's wind speeds, I knew. You could only hope there would not be too many fatalities, said Charlie Danger, a retired Miami-Dade building chief who crusaded for stricter windstorm codes. It pays to rebuild structures that withstand something like that. You minimize the loss of life and the loss of infrastructure. If you lose the infrastructure, you lose everything. Lackey said he and King, who jointly owned the Mexico Beach house, did not even refer to the minimum wind resistance required in Bay County. They built the Sand Palace to withstand 250-mile-per-hour winds. The house was fashioned from poured concrete, reinforced by steel cables and rebar, with additional concrete bolstering the corners of the house. The space under the roof was minimized so that wind could not sneak it underneath and lift it off. The home's elevation on high pilings was meant to keep it above the surge of seawater that usually accompanies powerful hurricanes. We're thinking that we need to build a house that would survive for generations, Lackey said. I believe the planet's getting warmer and the storms are getting stronger, said King, 68, an attorney. We didn't used to have storms like this, so people who live on the coast have to be ready for it. Though the family had the relief of knowing their house, which they rent out when they're not using it themselves for vacations, had remained standing, King needed to see for himself what damage the hurricane had done. He left Tennessee at 4 a.m. Saturday and drove his dark blue Ford F-150 pickup south for more than 7 hours, far longer than the trip would ordinarily take because of closed roads and recovery crew gridlock, to reach his property at the end of 36th Street. The siding that had wrapped around the stairway, providing access to the elevated house, was gone. And so were the stairs. But that was by design. The family's architect used breakaway walls that would tear free without ripping off any more of the structure. Now there was just a gaping hole and part of a handrail, leaving the five-bedroom, five-bathroom house accessible only by ladder. Up climbed King, away, awed by the fact that the structure had otherwise suffered only a little water damage and one cracked shower window. Even their in-home elevator appeared untouched. We can clean this up in a month, he said. But other folks? I don't know. Look at what these people suffered. The duplexes next door were wiped out. Three homes across the street were leveled down to concrete slabs. A fourth house, standing but with much of the roof and some walls caved in, was being searched by a rescue team. Two renters were unaccounted for, according to King. That house, too, he said, had been built with hurricanes in mind. It was supposed to be a fortress like this, King said, staring in disbelief. He said he previously owned a house on 42nd Street that still had watermarks in it from Hurricane Opal, the 1995 storm that, until a few days ago, had been a local benchmark for powerful cyclones. From his deck, King pointed, it was down there, and it's gone. That's the famous Mexico Beach Pier, he added, nodding toward a few decapitated wood pilings sticking out of the water. Up 36th Street, north of U.S. Highway 98, the main drag, more small houses had survived the wind but were gutted by the water, even though they were several blocks inland from the beach. John Hamilton spent a weekend afternoon shoveling dark muck out of the house belonging to his sister-in-law, Sandra Richards, and her husband, Jeff Richards, who live in Eufaula, Alabama, but have vacationed in Mexico Beach for decades. Paper towels in the highest kitchen cabinets were soaked. Fans on the ceiling, more than 8 feet up, were caked with mud. I can't believe I'm not just crying my eyes out, Sandra said, as her sister, Laura Hamilton, used a broken piece of door as a dustpan. It's incomprehensible. Jeff noted that the couple built the house with hurricane-resistant windows in 2004, after the new statewide code went into effect. Look at the windows. They're all here, he said. If the doors had held, we probably would have been all right. All those Mexico Beach houses that were built in the 1970s, they're gone, Sandra said. Like he said, much of the small town's charm came from its older houses and relative lack of overdevelopment compared with bigger tourist destinations farther west along the coast. Over the 4th of July holiday, which Mexico Beach celebrated with fireworks at the pier, Lackey's 5-year-old son, Keaton, learned how to snorkel off the beach in front of the house. There was a Subway. That was the one franchise eatery in town, he said. There were no traffic lights. It was nicknamed Mayberry by the Sea. King said he assumed Mike would spare the town, as other hurricanes had done. I said, it'll veer off. They always do. They go to Cancun or someplace, he said. As the storm took aim, though, their most recent renters brought the patio furniture indoors and oversaw a specialist hired by Lackey and King to seal the doors the day before landfall. The sort of measure Lackey readily acknowledged may be unaffordable for most people during an emergency. The renters ate at a beloved local seafood restaurant, Toucans, and then evacuated from town. They were probably the last people to eat there, like he said, of Toucans, which did not survive. A few days after the storm, the inside of the Sand Palace, immaculately decorated, remained surprisingly cool, a feature of its concrete walls. King said he hoped recovery crews from the Federal Emergency Management Agency could benefit from using their standing structure. If FEMA wants the house, they can have it for a few weeks, he said. I'm not going to complain about nothing. A version of this article originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll read one of the business columns today. It's titled Sears, American Tragedy or Creative Destruction? Shriveled and sickly, the once mighty Sears limped into bankruptcy this week, said Suzanne Kapner in the Wall Street Journal. The 125-year-old retailer has been a repository of American dreams. Its catalog, once delivered to nearly every American home, brought items that had been the province of city to the rural population, such as men's suits and vacuum cleaners, and even the steel string guitars that gave rise to the Delta Blues. Sears Roebuck and Company opened its first store in 1925, and by the 1930s was adding a new location every 3 days. In Chicago in 1973, it built the 110-story Sears Tower, then the world's tallest building. But in recent years, the retail giant was crippled by the unorthodox strategies of its billionaire majority owner, Eddie Lampert, who ran the firm by teleconference from Florida, and the rapid rise of Amazon, an endless online catalog that sucked profits out of the business. During Lampert's 13 years in charge, the company saw its number of stores plummet from 2,300 to 687. Its unraveling erased $30 billion in shareholder wealth from an April 2007 peak and more than 200,000 jobs. Lampert's bet on Sears was a spectacularly bad investment, said Catherine Burton in Bloomberg.com. The retailer was already struggling to compete with Walmart when it merged in 2005 with the Lampert-owned Kmart. Sears rolled through four CEOs in 8 years before Lampert himself took over in 2013. The hedge fund manager had a talent for maneuvering out of tight spots. He'd once persuaded four men who kidnapped him in January 2003 to let him go after holding him for 30 hours, blindfolded and handcuffed. But saving Sears required more than fast talk. Lampert tried to turn things around by slashing costs and pitting executives against one another. Along the way, the most unseemly element of the saga, he picked up a majority stake in Sears, valuable lands in spinoff, and his hedge fund owns roughly half of Sears' $5.3 billion debt, extracting more than $200 million a year in interest. The billionaire blamed the economy, the weather, Walmart, Amazon, and everything else for Sears' decline, said the New York Times in an editorial. In truth, the fall was caused by a combination of its owner's greed and others' innovation. The company's co-founder and namesake, Richard Warren Sears, harnessed two great networks to serve his enterprise, the railroads and the United States Postal Service. When the Postal Service introduced free rural delivery in 1896, every homestead in America came within reach of Sears' 1,500-page, 100,000-item catalog. Now, Amazon is one of the post office's biggest clients. And like the early Sears, it's pushing the boundaries on pricing, sourcing, marketing, and regulation. Sears' true cause of death was that ruthless but essential process called creative destruction, said Joe Nocera in Bloomberg.com. Yes, it's hard to envision anyone doing a worse job of running Sears than Lampert, but its end was ordained long before he arrived. Sears' fate was sealed at the apex of its power in the 1970s, when executives in Chicago saw writing lengthy memos to each other that had little to do with what was happening inside the stores. When they were asked which competitor they most feared, the answer that invariably came back was nobody. And we'll finish out, as we often do, on the Talking Points page. First article is titled, The Senate. Is it undemocratic? Americans are living under minority rule, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. This is supposed to be a democracy with a majority of votes deciding which party's candidates take office. But a president who lost the popular vote by 3 million ballots recently nominated Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh, in turn, was narrowly confirmed by a GOP-controlled Senate representing just 44% of all Americans. For that injustice, you can thank the Electoral College and the Senate, two institutions that create huge disparities of representation. The Constitution gives each state two senators, regardless of the population, which means that California's 40 million residents get the same Senate representation as Wyoming's 580,000 residents. That is absurd, said Dan Kennedy in WGBH.org. The framers wanted to prevent a tyranny of the majority, but didn't expect a minority controlling every branch of government, leaving the majority out in the cold. The Senate's anti-majority bias has a racial impact, said David Linhart in the New York Times. While large states such as California, New York, and Florida are racially diverse, smaller states tend to be overwhelmingly white. As a result, the Senate gives black Americans only 75% the representation of whites, while Hispanics get just 55%. Since it's unlikely small states will ever surrender their disproportionate power, granting statehood to the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, collectively home to 4 million people, more than 90% of them black or Hispanic, could make the Senate and the country a fairer place. If you start by insisting that every hue and ethnicity be perfectly represented in Congress, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times, you'll have to redraw every state and congressional district, too. Besides, the Constitution established states as sovereign entities in our Republican order, and the Senate was created to represent states, which have legitimate interests of their own. Just a few years ago, Democrats were bragging about their permanent majority, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Now they're complaining it's impossible for them to win under the governing regime that we've had for more than 200 years. Perhaps if Democrats hadn't given up on appealing to voters in flyover country, they'd still be able to elect senators in places like North Dakota, which had two Democratic senators as recently as 2010. Stop whining. The Senate is not a conspiracy against the left. Warren, did her DNA test backfire? Senator Elizabeth Warren managed this week to shine a spotlight on a mess that is 100% her own making, said Beckett Adams in WashingtonExaminer.com. Mocked by President Trump as Pocahontas for having claimed to be part Cherokee earlier in her academic career, Warren released a campaign-like video touting the results of a DNA test. This supposedly vindicating report found that she had a Native American ancestor 6 to 10 generations back. That makes Warren between 1/64th and 1/1024th Native American. The Cherokee Nation promptly rebuked her for claiming any tribal heritage based on that evidence. When Warren's Cherokee claim was first exposed during her Senate campaign in 2012, said David French in National Review, she had a chance to apologize, attribute it to family lore, and move on. Instead, her response has been positively Trumpian. No retreat, no surrender. But her DNA test only reveals she's a fraud with the same kind of mixed genetic background as most white Americans. Warren's DNA test proves one thing, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com. She's running in 2020 and running hard. Warren knows she has a weakness on her origin story and wants to stamp out this controversy long before the campaign. The DNA test helps, if only to prove to Democratic activists that she's going to fight back when Trump attacks her. The whole thing has been a buffoonish smear from the start, said Charles Pierce in Esquire.com. Like many Oklahomans, Warren was told growing up that she had a distant Cherokee ancestry. The Boston Globe last month published an exhaustive investigation that found Warren's ancestry played no part in this brilliant woman's hiring or professional success at Harvard Law School or other law schools, and that employers considered her a white woman. Trump once offered to donate $1 million to charity if Warren could prove any Native ancestry, but that notorious chiseler is now refusing to pay his debt. Trump also won't stop calling her Pocahontas, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. That slur serves to activate the racial grievances of white people who believe that racial minorities are given special advantages that allow them to vault past more deserving white people, especially men. It doesn't matter whether or not Warren has Native blood. What matters is that when a Trump voter sees Warren, all that bile comes bubbling up to the surface. And just enough time for one or two short notes. We'll start with, of the 114 Supreme Court justices in history, 111 have been white and 110 have been male. Every justice seated in the past 30 years received a law degree from Harvard, Columbia, or Yale. More than 1 million Americans have already uploaded their genetic information online using public genealogy sites. There's enough genetic data on family trees that researchers estimate more than half of the people in the U.S. could be identified by name with only a sample of their DNA and a few basic biographical facts, such as their age and where they live. And we will finish out with a quote from journalist and activist Dorothy Day. She says, "Love is a harsh and dreadful thing to ask of us, but it is the only answer." With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. The phone number is 919-832-5138.